Good morning. I'm State Representative Dave Pinto. I'm the chair of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee, and welcome to members of the public joining us. We're meeting pursuant to House Rule 10.01, which allows for virtual hearings of this type. And I want to direct your attention, if you're watching us as a member of the public, that our meeting materials are posted to our committee website. So you can find meeting agenda, and there's a whole lot of support materials and all kinds of things there. So please direct your attention there. Ms. Chambers, if we can start, as usual, with the taking of the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Pryor, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Damon.
Present.
Representative Juergens.
Present.
Representative Cotiza-Watoon.
Present.
Representative Morrison.
Morrison present.
Representative Wazlowick. Representative Wazlowick. And Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott present.
We do have a quorum.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Pryor, if you can move approval of our minutes for March 16.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And any additions or corrections, members? So hearing none, all in favor of approval of the March 16th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the minutes for March 16th are adopted. And so then I'm going to turn things over to Representative Pryor because I've got the first bill up. And maybe just to pause for a second, members. So we're going to be hearing in this first bill the administration's proposals in our area. We had heard a general overview of this some time ago now, but the language is available. This is a little bit of an unusual situation because at this point we would then be hearing final versions, including the supplemental budget forecast that came out in the last couple weeks ago, I guess. But everything is a bit slowed down in terms of bill production by the pandemic, but we're at least going to be hearing proposals from the administration. We'll talk more about how, if at all, they may change and then move on to a couple of other bills as well. So with that, Representative Pryor, turn things over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our next item on the agenda is House File 2230. Chair Pinto, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Yes, so moved, Madam Chair.
And I believe you have an A 21-0108 amendment.
I do, Madam Chair. Yeah. And perhaps so there's staff from the departments with us, and perhaps they can just briefly explain what is in that amendment, or perhaps Ms. Mock can either way. But this simply puts the bill in the shape that the administration wishes to have us consider it. So is there some, maybe I'll check first to see if there's somebody from the administration who can explain it, but otherwise I suspect Ms. Mock can assist.
And
see if anybody unmutes.
Good morning, Chair Pinto. I think it would be easiest for us if Ms. Mock would go through the amendment, if that's right. Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Summer. Ms. Mock, can you walk us through the amendment, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A21 amendment has three sections. One section just changes wording for the ECFE program. It changes in the bill, the ECFE program is changed to allow non-custodial parents to be part of the program. And the amendment changes non-custodial to ALLO parents. The amendment also adds a new section to the bill. That's a technical change related to retaining the VPK and School Readiness Plus seats. And then there's also an additional appropriation for $340,000 in each of fiscal years 22 and 23 for administration of the VPK program.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Mock. I think we're now ready to move the 0108 amendment. And put the bill in the way that the author and the administration would like. All in favor of the amendments, please unmute yourself and say aye.
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 Thank you. Opposed? All right, the amendment is adopted. And Chair Pinto, would you like to present your bill as amended?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, members. So again, we had a presentation on the general outlines of this some time ago earlier in the committee. As I mentioned, the language is now available to us. We're getting ready to remind, especially members of the public, early next week, we will be receiving a budget target along with other finance committees in the House and putting together a committee budget. And so, of course, we want to make sure that we're aware of what the proposals are from the administration. And so that's what this language is about. And so I think the plan, Madam Chair, is for representatives of the administration, starting with Ms. Hoganson, to confirm for us and discuss what's in the bill.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think first up then, we have Stephanie Hoganson from the Children's Cabinet. Ms. Hoganson, if you could please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Stephanie Hoganson, and I am the Policy Director for the Children's Cabinet. And I'm pleased to be here this morning with our agency partners and leaders from the Departments of Education, Health, and Human Services to provide an overview of House File of 2230, the combined governor's budget, early childhood budget proposals from those three agencies and within this committee's jurisdiction. As I've shared in this committee previously, the Children's Cabinet is an interagency partnership charged by the governor and lieutenant governor to make Minnesota the best place to grow up. This combined and coordinated budget proposal is one outcome of our efforts to align strategies, programs, and services to create a more effective and efficient government that better serves Minnesota children and families, with a focus on equity for our BIPOC and lower-income families. These proposals aim to help achieve improved outcomes for children identified in community engagement and cross-agency proposals prioritized through the Children's Cabinet leadership structure to increase access to childcare, to support family economic stability and child development, ensure healthy beginnings through strong infant and maternal health and supports, and provide early learning opportunities to help prepare children for school. And with a focus on equity and support for those who benefit most from early opportunities and supports, early learning opportunities and supports, these proposals aim to enhance existing programs that serve primarily BIPOC and lower income children, such as through increasing CCAP rates, maintaining the VPK slots, funding supports for Tribal Nation early learning opportunities, and ensuring summer early learning opportunities to prepare children after this pandemic year before they enter kindergarten. With that quick summary, each agency will walk through their sections of the bill and provide more details. And with that, I'll turn it over to you, Representative Pryor.
Thank you. And next on the list, I have Bobby Burnham from the Department of Education. Ms. Burnham, if you could please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Good morning, everyone. Bobby Burnham, Assistant Commissioner with the Office of Teaching and Learning at Minnesota Department of Education. And I will be walking through the education programs, beginning with Article 1. Section 1 reserves the 10.72% of the Head Start appropriation for tribal Head Start programs and clarifies the remaining distribution. Section 2 is a MDH-DHS provision. Section 3 provides breakfast reimbursement for early childhood special education students participating in voluntary pre-kindergarten and school readiness plus programs. Section 4 adds the non-custodial providers of childcare to the ECFE statute. Section 5 makes the 4,000 otherwise expiring voluntary pre-kindergarten school readiness plus seats permanent beyond the 2021 school year. Section 6 modifies the time frame in which an early learning scholarship must be used from 10 months to 3 months. Section 7 makes students receiving early childhood special education services eligible for English learner revenue. This allows these students to generate EL revenue, same as with students in VPK and School Readiness Plus programs. Section 8 simplifies and aligns the calculation of kindergarten pupil units by setting the minimum hours of instruction for kindergartners with disabilities to be the same as with other kindergarten students, to generate 1.0 pupil units minimum pupil unit minimum hours to is decreased from 875 to 825. Section 9 eliminates language in compensatory revenue statute associated with the expiration of voluntary pre-kindergarten seats in fiscal year 22. Article 2, Section 1 is a MDH-DHS provision. Article 3, under grants and appropriation, Section 1 directs DHS to allocate child care and development grant funds. Section 2 is the Department of Education appropriations, and the three new appropriations are the kindergarten or the KEP, Kindergarten Entry Profile Initiative and Intervention Program. This funding is for the administration of the Kindergarten Entry Profile for all VPK and School Readiness Plus students, and for the implementation of service and staffing changes that will enhance data collection and analysis and provide more robust technical assistance to school districts, charter schools, and mixed delivery partners. The second new funding appropriation is summer preschool for 4 and 5 year olds, funding the summer preschool for 4 and 5 year olds. Note this was already discussed in depth at Tuesday's hearing. And the third new appropriation is the early childhood tribal education and engagement grants, funding for an early childhood tribal education package that will provide grants to each of the Minnesota's 11 tribal nations to focus on early learning tribal package, focusing on family engagement, language revitalization, and early learning recruitment and retention of American Indian teachers. And with that, I will turn it back to Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Burnham. Next on my list is Lisa Bailey from the Department of Human Services. Ms. Bailey, if you could please identify yourself for the records and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you. And I apologize. I've got the sun coming in on me here. My name is Lisa Bailey. I'm the Acting Assistant Commissioner of Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. Thank you for your time and for allowing me to discuss this child care assistance program and this important piece of the governor's budget proposal. The governor proposes increases in CCAP reimbursement rates to the 30th percentile of most recent market rates. Now, you may recall that during the 2020 legislative session, the legislature passed a rate increase updating CCAP maximum rates to pay at the 25th percentile of the 2018 market rate survey. This rate increases therefore went into effect in September of 2020, resulting in the first increase in CCAP rates in 6 years. Now, because the increase was tied directly to the 2018 market survey, it will be out of compliance as soon as we receive the new market rate survey, which is legislatively required to happen this year in 2021. And that's why we're back before you making this request today. The total estimated cost is $47.5 million in the first biennium and $85.2 million in the second biennium to update the maximum rates and registration fees paid to child care providers in the child care assistance program. Now, the way those costs are funded, the general fund cost is $12,000 for system changes in each of the two biennium. And all remaining costs are offset with federal child care development block grant funds. And I note, I'm always supposed to note that if they're available at the rates as expected, we do expect those rates to be available. Now, why is this required? Why is this necessary? What will this do? With an increase from 25 to 30%, more providers could have more of their prices charged to private pay families fully covered, meaning that the anticipated coverage, more of those families will have their rates covered. The slightly increasing those CCAP rates from that 25th to 30th increases access for children and families who rely on CCAP to access childcare in the same market as private pay families. It also keeps the financial burden to families as low as possible and to providers as well. That's the high level overview, and I'm happy to stand for questions afterward. So I'll turn it back to you, Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. We have next on the list, Karen Hogg from Department of Health. If you could please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Karen Fogg. I'm the Maternal and Child Health Section Manager at the Child and Family Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. Under Article 2, we are requesting authority to conduct fetal and infant death reviews. The purpose of this process is to understand the root cause of these unfortunate deaths and to take action to prevent a wide range of local social, economic, public health, educational, environmental, and safety factors that contribute to the tragic fetal and infant losses. I apologize, I'm getting a low internet connection and I'm gonna stop my video.
Thank you. I was wondering if it was me or if it was you that was frozen, but we can hear you just fine, thank you.
Okay, great, thanks. So this is a methodology that was developed by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, as well as the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in the 90s. 28 states currently use this review methodology, and we're seeking to, by seeking to understand why these tragedies occur, MDH is also seeking to partner with communities to create action to further reduce deaths and reduce decrease disparities in the rates of poor outcomes among Black and American Indian infants in our state. The authorization for these type of studies did originally appear, but was sunsetted in 2001. Under this authority, MDH will convene a confidential multidisciplinary committee to review all fetal and infant deaths. We're seeking to review fetal deaths after 20 weeks gestation, more commonly called stillbirths, and deaths occurring to children before their first birthday. This committee may include members like clinicians, medical examiners, representatives from healthcare institutions, and also representatives from the communities that are disproportionately impacted. Members review the story, what happened to this baby and this family leading up to conception until the time of death. Families are invited to participate in an interview if they so choose, and this can be particularly helpful in bringing forward information that's not included in a medical record, such as housing instability, lack of connection or support in communities, or potentially experiencing racial or other discrimination in accessing care and services. These committees draft generalizable recommendations that might improve systems of care, services, and resources to women, infant, and families. These draft recommendations are then passed on to a group called a community action team. This group refines recommendations and implements actions to improve policies and programs that were identified through this review process. These groups do not have access to private information and can have a much more inclusive membership with a focus on community and local organizations working to support families. The action teams may be created to address specific issues such as preterm birth, or perhaps a specific population or geography, thinking about American Indian infant mortalities, or potentially thinking about rural areas. Thank you for your time today, and I'm happy to answer additional questions.
Thank you, Ms. Fogg, and thank you to all the testifiers this morning. We now have time for member questions. Mr. Chair, for your
visit. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to suggest, and there may be member clarification questions of the testifiers. I was going to suggest that we take a look at the early childhood fiscal spreadsheet that's posted on the website. It may make sense to ask Ms. Adrians to just clarify that for us a little bit, but that contains, I think, some helpful information regarding these proposals as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Adrians, can you identify yourself and proceed?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good morning. I hope that you all have access to this. I'm not technologically savvy enough to share my screen, I don't think. But there was an attachment sent this morning that contains the early childhood committee spreadsheet. And what it contains is it has the base funding for the programs that are that the fiscal accounts that the committee has jurisdiction over. So it contains those for the human services portion, which is the MFIP childcare, the basic sliding fee childcare, and then childcare development grants. If there are specific questions, I'm going to let Mr. Berg answer those. He's the expert in that area. And then for the education side, it lists a number of programs for early education that fall under the jurisdiction of the committee as well. And what the spreadsheet shows, it shows the base numbers from the end of last calendar year from December, and then the governor's recommendations. And the reason that we use those numbers instead of the February forecast numbers is because the governor's recommendations are compared to those December numbers. And then when we receive updated numbers for the governor's recommendation, I believe this week, then we will issue another tracking sheet that has the February forecast numbers and then the governor's recommendations, those updates. And so what this shows is in, there are all of the columns with the different years, and then the columns that are sort of a darker gray shade show the difference. And this is where it's a really nice place to find where the governor changes the base numbers. So you should be able to see, for example, the early learning opportunities for 4 and 5 year olds, that shows up as a $20 million item there. And I'm happy to answer more questions if that's useful for members at this time.
Mr. Chair, should we, I think at this point, it's perhaps clarifying questions if anybody has some, and then more general questions after that. So, you know, new information with just arrived with this fiscal analysis, the financial look at it. Any member questions at this point? I am not seeing any. And so perhaps back to you, Mr. Chair, for any final words and then also discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So I want to direct everyone's attention as well. It was on February 16th that we received the first preview of these proposals, and there was a PowerPoint associated with that. It's on our committee website, and perhaps I'll ask staff to post it for today's hearing as well. The department presenters didn't use this particular PowerPoint today, but we did receive it previously, and so I asked to have that be put up. Because it did have a background on the proposals. I want to make sure that folks noticed what Ms. Adrian said, that the spreadsheet that we have posted on the website right now does not take into account the most recent numbers, because we still have to have those work through, but it certainly will. And I don't know if there's any information that our administration folks can share with us regarding how these proposals may shift, if at all, following the supplemental numbers. Because that seems like an important thing to do as well today. Is there any information, and perhaps I'll ask by you, Madam Chair, if there's anything that they can share with us about how those may shift?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do we have someone that can unmute themselves and identify themselves and perhaps answer that question?
This is Stephanie Hoganson with the Children's Cabinet. The governor's supplemental budget will be released later this afternoon, so we can't share any information this morning.
Okay, all right. And back to you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, in that case, we'll be, members, I certainly expect that we'll be hearing, receiving information then, and those, the timing this session is getting is just challenging because of some of the constraints that we're under. But we'll certainly attempt time to take a final review before we make our decisions. We certainly want to hear from the administration what their suggestions are. But Madam Chair, I think that's it then in terms of bill presentation and ready for any discussion and then wrapping things up.
All right, member comments, discussion, questions at this point. And I will remind members that this is a bill that's being laid over for possible inclusion in our final budget bill. And I do have one comment, something that did strike me as we're going through the presentation, which I think speaks to another bill, which we've heard, which is how fractured our system is. is that we have to hear from multiple agencies to really pull together what we're trying to do in the early childhood space. So I think it's certainly added a level of complexity for putting together this bill, which we appreciate the Children's Cabinet for I think leading that and making that seem comprehensible to us. But I think this is something that we can do better on in the future. So, and this is I think a pretty good example of a need that we have and a problem that we have. And looking for any other comments this morning, questions? And I am not seeing any. So back to you, Mr. Chair, for any final comments.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. And again, this will be an ongoing conversation. I would hope and expect that next week we'd be able to get just a little more information about changes regarding supplemental budget before we finally make our own budget decisions. So thanks.
All right. With that, the chair lays over House File 2230 as amended for possible inclusion in the early childhood budget bill. And I will hand the gavel back to Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. I'm asking Chair Dabney now if he would like to move House File 2203 and place that before the committee. Get you unmuted, sir.
Yeah, I'll do that as soon as I get unmuted, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2203 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in a future bill, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Excellent. Yeah, please. And so we have that motion. The motion has been made. And so please present your bill and then we'll bring up the testifiers.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2203 initiates a conversation on removing the arbitrary cap on that the state has placed on Pathway 2 early learning scholarships. Pathway 2 scholarships go to 4-star rated providers, both public and private. And parents can use those scholarships to access school-based programs, Head Start, child care centers, tribal programs, or for family care. By going to providers, they assure that there is high-quality child care available in communities where young families need access. Minnesota established an arbitrary cap on Pathway 2 scholarships, capping parental access to high-quality child care opportunities. The arbitrary cap limits parental choice at the same time that we know that high quality providers such as Head Start have testified that they are able to serve less than 25% of the eligible children in their program. When we look at children and families who benefit from Pathway 2 scholarships, state data indicates that they are slightly more racially and ethnically diverse than those accessing Pathway 1 scholarships, more likely to be experiencing homelessness, to speak a language other than English at home, to be a family with a teenage mother, or from a family that qualifies for free or reduced price lunch services. And a reminder that to receive a Pathway 2 scholarship, providers must be 4-star rated, our highest rating. And at the same time, many of these, I think, of both Head Start and school-based programs in this situation, have other additional accreditation quality standards that they must adhere to, providing an additional layer of assurance to parents of the quality of the care for their children each and every day. Mr. Chair, I have two testifiers with me today, Ms. Stunkel from Columbia Heights Public Schools and Mr. Gratzky from the Minnesota Head Start Association.
Thank you, Chair Dabney, and we'll start then with Ms. Stunkel. If you can please identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Pinto and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you this morning regarding House File 2203. My name is Kristen Stunkel. I'm the Director of Community Education and Communications for Columbia Heights Public Schools, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Community Education Association and 3- and 4-year-old learners in Columbia Heights School District and throughout Minnesota. We are aware that you heard a bill last week that would significantly increase the funding for early learning scholarships. We support that bill and hope this bill, which removes the freeze on Pathways 2 scholarships, will allow families the choice to send their child to our high-quality programs. Pathways 1 and Pathways 2 scholarships are very similar with only one distinct difference, stable funding for the provider to ensure ongoing programming for children and families that choose our programs, which is what Pathways 2 provides. Established programs providing programming year after year, families count on these programs, which become an integral part of their family, providing continuity of care for the child and support for parents. Teachers in these programs often report having worked with multiple children from the same family. Teachers develop strong, trusting relationships with families, and participation in school-based programs enable families to access additional school resources and support. Providers rely on stable funding to retain teachers and continue high-quality programming for families. More than ever, Pathways 2 scholarships funds are critical in order to for early childhood providers to serve families who qualify for financial assistance. In Columbia Heights Public Schools, we are a district rich in diversity, with 39% of our students identifying as Hispanic, 32% identified as Black or African American, 17% identified as white, and the other 12% identified as Asian, two or more races, and American Indian. We are a high poverty school district with 74% of our students qualifying for free and reduced lunch. Our students come to us from all over the world, and 31% are English learners. I share these demographics because the diversity of our K-12 system is reflected in our early childhood education and childcare programs. In fact, 60% of our pre-K-3 learners and 50% of our Mini Adventures preschool childcare participants are English learners. This is important to note because Pathways 2 provides scholarships for 83% of our Mini Adventures children and 48% of our pre-K-3 students. When a family chooses our school district, early childhood care and education programs, our staff work with them on the registration and payment process and helps them with the application to access scholarship funds. Throughout the state of Minnesota, families are receiving such support to enroll their child in their chosen programs. Just as community education is a statewide network of education and enrichment, Pathways 2 also provides consistent and established early childhood care and education opportunities for our young scholars throughout our great state. Thank you for your support for removing the freeze on Pathways 2 scholarships to allow families to continue to select and send their child to a high-quality public and private provider. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Knuckle. Thank you for your work for kids, and we appreciate you being here. Mr. Gratke, you are up. If you can please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Pinto and committee members. I'm Craig Gratke. I'm from the Minnesota Head Start Association. I'm the executive director there. And I would just say I would appreciate if the cap was removed on Pathway 2. Many of our Head Start programs in Minnesota use Pathway 2 to extend the day or the number of days per year for children in our programs, making them more full day, full year kinds of programs. They also spend money on additional staff. And some of that is staff to support children's mental health, bilingual staff, to bring interpreters into programming, those kinds of things, along with some transportation. And transportation is key for a lot of our families that, as you know, our Head Start children are at 100% of poverty or less. And so families have a lot of barriers around getting children into program. And so a number of our Head Start programs have chosen to provide busing and get kids into sites. So it's a varied use of those funds to really provide more services and to get kids the services that they need. And I think the other part of that truly is Pathway 2 is all about parent choice. And a lot of our Head Start programs, or all of our Head Start programs, are parent driven. Parents are part of the decision-making process. We have a policy council that votes on funding, votes on how to provide programming. We have to do all of those kinds of things. And so parents are in the driver's seat in Head Start programs. And that goes right down to the local level of enrolling children in programs. They come to us, parents make choices about applying for Pathway 2 to get those extended services, to get those things provided for them. And so, again, I would say, really, this is removing the cap would only expand those services, and we'd be able to touch more kids. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gradke. We have a couple of members of the public testifying. Before we get to that, I just want to make sure again to direct the attention of members of the public and members of the committee as well to our committee website. And those materials were sent around to members of the committee, where there's a number of materials, including input from members of the public regarding this bill and the prior bill, et cetera. So just want to direct folks' attention to that. So thank you, Mr. Gradke, for your work. We've got the next testifier up is Erica Moss. So if you can please identify yourself and then please proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Erica Moss, Closed Gaps 5-5. When Pathway 2 was created, we were assured by the Commissioner of Education that Pathway 2 was a temporary transitional program that was necessary because of insufficient supply of quality options for parents. 8 years later, we have seen the supply of parent aware rated programs increase by more than fivefold, from 529 when scholarships first started to 2,921 today. And 8 years later, what was promised to be a temporary program would be expanded under this bill. Our original concerns about Pathway 2 have all been borne out. First, we were worried that Pathway 2 isn't portable, meaning that children get cut off from their learning and care when their families change homes or jobs. I was recently visiting with the leader of a homeless shelter that receives both Pathway 1 and Pathway 2 funding, and they told me that they prefer Pathway 1 because they worry what happens when Pathway 2 funded children leave the shelter and get cut off from their early learning. We should all be concerned about that. Second, in 2013, we expressed concern that the rigid Pathway 2 model takes away parent flexibility by allocating scholarships via earmarks. Parents who are empowered to choose by Pathway 1 scholarship pick school-based or Head Start programs about 19% of the time. That speaks well of those excellent programs and is in line with what you'd expect, given that they make up about 20% of the available options. By comparison, 83% of Pathway 2 goes to Head Start or school-based programs through that earmark process. However, there are good reasons for parents and guardians not to choose school-based or Head Start programs 100% of the time. I think we all are all familiar with the decision-making process that goes into this sort of thing. Location is important. Schedule, part-time schedule can be a barrier, or a program doesn't fit cultural or linguistic preferences. Those things are extremely important to the diverse group of families using scholarships, and we should trust them to direct those resources. Instead of giving that power to MDE. Finally, an expansion of Pathway 2 at this moment is moving against a consensus direction in early learning. First, brain science leads us to start investments earlier. Only 6.6% of Pathway 2 scholarships go to infants and toddlers versus 40% of Pathway 1. Second, a mixed delivery system with a diverse workforce is essential. The EPIC report recently released acknowledged that simply expanding school-based programming as Pathway 2 has done in the past without addressing the underlying inequities of the childcare system exacerbates those inequities. And finally, equity goals demand we serve those who benefit most first and deeply. 55% of Pathway 1 recipients are in priority groups, homeless, foster care, child protection, or teen parent versus only 8% in Pathway 2. And I need to just correct a little bit of the data that was given earlier. I made the same mistake when I saw this chart from MDE. It is the case that children experiencing homelessness are much more often served with Pathway 1, 3,245 children experiencing homelessness versus 428 for Pathway 2, and children of a teen parent also 24 with Pathway 2 and 120 with Pathway 1. I think that's a misreading of the chart that MDE put out, which I can see how that would happen. And the other thing I just wanted to state, based on the numbers we have from MDE from fiscal year 2020, 59.1% of Pathway 1 recipients identify as BIPOC versus 48.6 for Pathway 2. And with that, Mr. Chair, thank you for your time. We oppose this bill and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Moss. Representative Bennett, there's one more testifier after Ms. Moss. Do you want to ask a clarifying question now, or do you mind waiting till after? Okay, you're okay.
Thanks,
waiting.
Mr. Chair, I can wait, yeah. Thank you.
Okay, good. Okay, yeah, and then we'll certainly get to you. Okay, good. And so then, Ms. Cunningham, you are our final testifier. If you can please identify yourself. I think you're joining us by phone, which is just fine. And then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm having technical difficulties, so here I am just on phone. I think you all know what I look like after the last few weeks. My name is Cindy Cunningham. I've been a licensed family child care provider in St. Paul for 25 years and am the current public policy chairperson for Minnesota Child Care Provider Information Network, MCPIN, which is the 501c3 statewide association for licensed child care providers. I'm testifying on behalf of MCPIN opposing House File 2203, which lifts the cap on Pathways to Awards, which would lead to an even larger disparity in distribution of early learner scholarships. I have been researching and involved in these discussions since 2014. The basic question which is being asked is who is going to control the distribution of state dollars? Parents, as the program was intended, or higher priced organizations who are essentially self-serving in their distribution? The organization makes the determination of who receives the dollars. They can entice families to their programs as they have ready dollars versus the wait for Pathways 1 and no funding. Early learner scholarships were established to support families in need for early childhood education, primarily childcare. With the potential expansion of early learner scholarships to the birth and potential full funding, this lifting of the cap is even more dynamic. Early learner scholarships were not created to support organizations or institutions. As the testifiers have previously stated, Pathways 2 does just that by supporting staff and allowing them to expand. These programs have become the comptrollers of the distribution of early learners' funds. The cap was placed to ensure that schools' Head Starts and centers did not become the sole placement to utilize an early learner scholarship. The rollout of Parent Aware and early learner scholarships has been complicated for licensed family childcare and therefore not as well utilized as should be. MCPIN is actively working to support licensed family childcare to participate in both Parent Aware and early learner scholarships. There has been much testimony over the past few weeks, in particular Tuesday, about the value of licensed family childcare. We appreciate the value and the strokes. However, this bill degrades our value. Where money is spent is an indication of value. This bill devalues licensed family childcare as it shifts a family's ability to make an appropriate care choice. It opens the gates for schools and institutions to control even more of the dollars and makes it even more difficult for licensed family childcare to participate and be a choice where families can spend money and where the state invests the dollars. Pathways 2 is only a viable process for organizations or institutions, not for licensed family childcare, and in particular, small centers. It is a process every 2 years currently being done. This cap removal would likely be in effect this round of distribution, therefore allowing MD to approve even more programs. I ask you to reference MCCA, the center association testimony, regarding the school process. It is an inequitable process for most, unless you are in the school setting. In the years of early learner scholarships, approximately only 3 licensed family child care providers have been able to qualify to receive a Pathways 2. Most do not apply, as the process requires a 4-star rating, a quantity of children eligible enrolled, and a potential for children eligible for early learner scholarships to be used. The parent aware process has not been a positive path for licensed family childcare until recently, so fewer have a 4-star rating. Licensed family childcare do not have quantity. We have quality of relationship within our communities. Numbers in a community do not override any one family's need for assistance. Licensed family childcare are frequently referred as the most culturally responsive settings for families, and yet we are excluded from the possibility of this funding stream. Families cannot choose the most appropriate setting as there are not dollars to spend. The schools, Head Starts, and centers control the money. I have been in many conversations regarding the establishment of Pathways 2 and its development. And as Erica Moss has explained, this was supposed to be an assist to start the schools. It was not supposed to be continue nor become the major funders. Early learner scholarships awarded to a family, Pathways 1 was intended to be the funding process to give families choice. Schools, Head Start, and centers can all accept Pathways 1. Beginning 2023, early learner scholarships can only be utilized at 3- and 4-star ratings. So the argument for only 4-star being the premier setting will be diminished. Currently, MDE, which is school-focused, has come to be the gatekeeper. I would argue that the program is misplaced and MDE has a conflict of interest in how the program is viewed. They work towards Pathways 2 as it benefits schools. It does not benefit all families' choices. Schools are not nor should become our primary child care providers. There are many schools in the state which are starting to considering or are opening child care. With an ability to control more early learner scholarship dollars, they are financially empowered to become the narrow option for those children and families that the early learner scholarships are intended to serve, which is a diverse population. Organizations and institutions are monopolizing the utilization of early learner scholarships to the detriment of family choice and limiting that participation of licensed family child cares and providing services to these families. The wait list continues.
Ms. Cunningham, I'm almost done.
And families can only find assistance if they place their child in a school Head Start or center. I ask you to reference Misty Fisk's testimony before you. A parent was unable to receive funding without going to a program that has control of the pathway $2. That's not a choice. This is inequity and control of public funding. Best fit is what is needed for children. Inequitability in the distribution of money is what will do that. Please recognize and respect the testimonies you have heard and have before you. Close Gaps by Five, Think Small, the Center Association, MCCA, and Licensed Family Child Care are implore you to make the right decision. Only the schools and programs which are benefiting have money to have this money to distribute to families benefit from lifting this cap. Families across the state do not benefit. Families continue to lose their choice. Please oppose House File 2203.
Thank you, Ms. Cunningham. We've got a couple of folks on the list. We did have a fair amount of testimony there, and that I want to offer you, Chair Dabney, if you want to provide a response to any of that right now, or maybe we go to some member questions and we'll come back to you. I just want to give you, as the bill's author, since we had several folks testify, there may be some things you want to respond to now, or kind of what's your preference as the bill author?
Well, Mr. Chair, I right now, about 47% of the funding goes, 46, 47, 48% goes to Pathway 2 scholarships. A little over 50%, 52, 53% goes to Pathway 1 scholarships. But we set an arbitrary cap on Pathway 2 scholarships. And parent choice is important in childcare, but parents can only choose a program that exists in their community. And Pathway 2 scholarships assures that there are high quality, reliable, known, respected programs in communities across the state. And so I think if we're going to talk about choice, we need to talk about how we ensure that reliable, respected childcare opportunities are available. And the Pathway 2 scholarships provide those. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll deal with member questions.
No, good. We'll do that. And then we'll certainly, of course, come back to you throughout this as well. So Representative Bennett, you were first on the list, so please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to look at my notes here, too, because I've been taking notes. Very good testimony. And thank you, Representative Dabney, for my dog peeking in here. Hopefully he doesn't interrupt. For Representative Dabney for bringing this subject to light. And I have a question for Ms. Moss, actually a couple questions. The first one, in dealing with Pathway 1 and the nature of the portability of that pathway, how does that help, especially our vulnerable students, you know, the homeless, students in poverty, students in foster care, and then I'll save my second question is very similar and I'm gonna add that onto it. So, the portability, how does that advantage those vulnerable students? And also the nature of parental choice, being able to choose which program. And I would like to push back a little bit, Representative Dabney. There are a lot of quality non-Head Start, non-Pathway 2 programs in our state. And I don't want to devalue them because parents are choosing them many times. So the parental choice part, how does that also especially help the vulnerable students, again, the homeless, those in poverty, those in foster care, and that's for Ms. Moss. Thank you.
Yeah, we'll go to Ms. Moss, and I want to make sure to give Representative Dabney a chance to, since you invoked him, a chance to respond there too, but Ms. Moss, we'll go to you to answer Representative Bennett's question.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative Bennett, thanks for the question. So portability is absolutely essential, and in fact, when we worked on the scholarship pilot and figured out what the policies were going to be, we spent a ton of time with DHS and the lead on CCAP at the time talking about the kinds of things that led to disruptions in care and how those disruptions in care are harmful to children. Obviously, you all on this committee are well studied in the brain science. We know that little kids' brains are just developing so, so rapidly. And wherever they are, that's happening. If they're in a negative environment, it's happening. If they're in positive environments, it's happening, and stability is critically important. So the idea that we would design a public policy that we know has this flaw and not figure out a way to fix it, to me is, I only can think of very negative words. I think that the example that I gave is a perfect one. Children in homeless shelters, for example, this is a priority group for scholarships. Many children experiencing homelessness use the scholarship program, specifically Pathway One. And those kids, are maybe in shelter for 2 months, 3 months, and they are in childcare there. And then they go and settle in, hopefully, a permanent residence and move. When they move, it would be horrible if they started from square one without a scholarship. If they were on a Pathway Two scholarship, for example, and there was a waiting list in the area where they lived for Pathway One, they would move without that continued support. At the same time, you could have a similar situation with a child in foster care. Maybe they get reunited with their parents. And wouldn't it be immensely helpful if when they were reunited, they came with some support to continue attending a high quality childcare program? Maybe they're changing locations enough that the place where they were going when they were in foster care doesn't make sense anymore. Families move. There are all kinds of disruptions that can happen. And I think that with the Pathway 2 approach of simply saying the money stays with the program and does not follow the child, is just really not good public policy when you consider the brain science or the simple facts about what kids need in their learning continuity. To the second question about parent choice, our organization feels very, very strongly about parent choice. And the way that we think about it is that parents are directing the resources. And so, again, families are choosing with Pathway One, 20% of the time, about 18 point something something percent of the time are choosing Head Start or school-based programs. Those are good options. They're excellent options. We know that. I often say that I'm so confident that they're great options that parents will choose them with Pathway One, and parents do. But they don't choose those programs at a rate that's outsized to their presence in the in the system of providers. And so when you look at the fact that 83% of Pathway Two dollars are going to Head Start or school-based programs versus the 20% in Pathway One, I think it raises the question about the goals of allocating Pathway Two dollars and whether those goals are informed by or are matching parent perceptions and parent choices. Our organization, we're rooted in the idea of parent empowerment. We think that empowerment happens with choice. We get concerned when a policy removes choice from families, the sort of most local entity in this whole equation, and removes that choice to an organization like MBE. We work great with the department. We love our colleagues there. But I think, members, that you can see the potential problems that come with taking power away from parents to choose and giving that power to a bureaucracy.
Representative Bennett, we'll go back to you, but I do want to make sure to direct to Representative Dabney to comment on this parental choice issue. But Representative Bennett, did you have a follow-up to Ms. Moss about this?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank you for going to represent Dad, because I may have misinterpreted what he said too, so I appreciate giving him that opportunity, and then if I could maybe respond to that discussion. Thanks.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, part of the reason we've structured this hearing in such a way to have a little bit of extra time, so please, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bennett. I think there's a couple of pieces to talk about here, and there's a tension around choice and quality, and we know that when the early learning scholarships were first established, we said, well, programs have to, who receive children who bring in a Pathway One scholarship have to reach this level of quality. And then we said, okay, we're going to put that requirement off a couple of years. And then we put it off again a couple of more years. So it's always kind of twinkling on the horizon when we're going to require 4-star quality rating of programs that receive Pathway One scholarship funds. At the same time, the Pathway Two scholarship recipient providers are four-star quality rated providers. Parents have a choice because these Pathway 2 scholarships assure that choice. Absent those scholarships, there would be less parental choice available. And yet we've put an arbitrary cap on that choice and that assurance of quality.
Representative Bennett.
Excuse me. Yeah, and thank you, Representative Dabney. I get that. I think we have to be very careful, though, as government, that what we're doing, and I don't think anybody is intending this, but what we're doing is not pushing out options for parents and in various communities by the way we fund things. And I think perhaps a better way than funneling funds into one certain type of program is to, you know, offer more grants, and I'm in support of that, to increase the availability of many different opportunities for parents to choose their child care and their early childhood programs. I do think, you know, the parental choice, the four-star, three-star program, that is good, and it has a quality component. But I think parents also know what quality is, and they are using their feet and their dollars through Pathway One to choose the quality that they want for their child. And so I think we just have to make sure we're balancing this. And I don't see that here as much. I would much prefer us to increase those opportunities without funneling money into one source. But I will stop there, and I appreciate the conversation. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Representative Bennett. Representative Pryor, we'll move to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's good to have this discussion this morning and to be able to make this accessible to the public and to be getting this public input. So I just want to start by saying that. So, you know, there's one thing I think this discussion, again, just highlights what we have found to be so true since we started meeting as a committee this year, this session, as well as the sessions before when we first started, which is that we have a early care and learning system that is starved for funding. And what we've set up is no one has enough. Whether you're a family child care provider, whether you're a system, a center that's trying to start in a community, or if you're trying to start a great school-based program, you are chronically short of funding. And there's just not enough resources. And we said, you know, this started 8 years ago. Those are 8 years of the worst deficits in funding in our early care and learning system. So the fact that we have any four-star centers in the state is kind of an accomplishment. And the other thing that we've seen in our testimony and that we've heard is that these businesses are fragile and that they need stable support. And this is one of the only avenues that we've been giving for this kind of stable support. And I think of the program that was a high quality program that was in my community in Hopkins that closed down during the pandemic. And it's because they always worked on the margins. And when they lost the subsidy that they had in rent, they had no choice but to close down. They just couldn't make ends meet. So I think that, you know, if we take away this idea that there's not enough to go around, and so we have to cut off certain structures or part of our infrastructure because there's not enough to go around, and that's what we would be doing. That's what we're doing with this cap on Pathways 2. We're just saying we're cutting it off because there's not enough to go around, and so we have to ration the system. So I think if we take that assumption out, then we would have a different look at what these Pathways 2 is doing. Now, I do believe that, you know, the idea of mobility for, especially at our most risk population, you know, that's something to look at, but I think that's something to look at separately than the Pathway 2's, how we're using those right now, because Pathway 2 is kind of like school choice that we have in the K-12. Parents get to choose the school system that works for them. Maybe it's the one that's their local neighborhood one, or maybe it's one that's, you know, across the river. And what they do is they vote with their feet, and then state funding follows. So I think, and it follows for the whole year. We don't pull it out if they decide in the middle of the year that they want to switch schools again. So, you know, I think it's a little bit more like that system than the other thing. So appreciate Chair Dabney for bringing us, you know, another option that we have. And it's basically, it's another tool in the toolbox that says, here's how we can support really high quality early care and learning and do it in a way that is sustainable and can be make a permanent structure. And we're on that path, where we're trying to get back on that path. So thanks, Chair Dabney, for bringing this forward and getting the discussion going. And as we figure out what our resources are right now, today, I think this is definitely something to be looking at. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. We'll move to, that was more the nature of a comment. So Representative Dabney, we'll get back to you. But Representative Dana, first, we'll go to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Chair Dabney, for bringing this forward. I really appreciate the discussion that has gone on to be able to understand even deeper how both Pathway 1 and Pathway 2 affect our families and our students. Just a point of clarification from Ms. Moss, if I could. I believe I heard this correct, but I'm not sure. And we know in this committee, we've heard the importance of all of the early childhood, but especially those infants and toddlers. And I believe, Ms. Moss, did you say that 40% of Pathway 1 goes to infants and toddlers? I'm not sure if I have that right, but could you clarify or expand on that, please?
Ms. Moss.
Mr. Chair and Representative DeMuth, yes, that is correct. So in Pathway 1, 40% of the recipients are infants and toddlers, and I would just applaud you all for that priority policy that was established several years ago that has really made this possible. It's not just that 40% are infants and toddlers. 40% are infants and toddlers, and the vast majority of those infants and toddlers are in the priority categories. By contrast, just so you have it, Representative Damuth, at 6.6% in Pathway 2. And I think that this is another kind of, there are a lot of systems questions when you do these kinds of earmark policies. And one of the systems questions is, I know you all have seen the graphs of how much investment is going in by age group of the public funding sources. And there's a lot of funding in ongoing funding streams for low-income 3 and 4-year-olds, not just scholarships. There are 3 school funding streams that provide stable funding to school-based programs. Head Start has a state stream and a federal stream. You know, it really is, when you talk about stable ongoing funding, it really is the childcare sector that doesn't have that same opportunity. And again, you know, it's 86 or 83% of Pathway 2 is going to Head Start and school-based programs, which do have their own ongoing funding streams. And so I guess if I were, we don't support the earmark, the kind of Pathway 2 approach, as I've made pretty clear. But if we were going to do it, I guess I would say to focus on the sort of endangered species in the mix, the programs that don't have those ongoing funding streams. I understand Representative Pryor's point about, there's not enough money. We're very, very much on the same page about that. I would actually argue that it gets easier to do the Pathway 1 parent choice model when you do something like what Representative Katiza Watun has in her bill, $415 million in Pathway 1 scholarships year after year circulating around communities, that would really give a good kind of response. And I also just wanted to mention that 95% of Pathway 1s are going to 3 or 4 stars at this point. So there really isn't a big Pathway 2 need for, you know, the 4-star options. I think there are lots of options now, a lot more than there were certainly when scholarships started.
Thank you. And thank you. Representative Damuth, I was actually interested in exploring the infant toddler issue a little bit myself. If you have a follow-up on that, then please do. But if you're going to move on to something else, I was actually going to ask a little bit. But Representative Damuth, we'll see.
I don't have a follow-up, but thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Moss, for clarifying. I think that's really important information that we need to take into consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Damuth. Yeah, and I'd love to hear from Chair Dabney or his testifiers about that thought about the infant toddler issue. That's something that, as you know, is particularly close to my heart. And just trying to think that through regarding this issue as well, making sure that we're providing the care and development and learning for the very youngest kids. Chair Dabney, I'll look to you, but you may want to hand it off to one of your testifiers either way.
I wonder if Mr. Gratzky wanted to get involved in this. I think, you know, this is complex, and Chair, you've always been a advocate for kind of that 0 to 3 being the key place for state investment, and I have a deep respect for that. But I really think Representative Pryor is the one who hit it out of the park here this morning. The fact is that the state doesn't invest to meet the need for our youngest learners. It doesn't invest either physical resources, dollars, into our young families, or policies like family medical leave so that moms can stay home with their little ones, or dads can have paternity leave to help the family transition and bond themselves with their infants or with a sick family member. There's a number of policies that we as a state and we as a nation have just refused to invest into our youngest learners. This is a part of that, but Representative Pryor was absolutely right. We need to take some fresh eyes on this and decide whether our youngest learners up until age 5 are and their families are worth investing in.
Thank you. And before I move to Mr. Gradke, I really appreciate you highlighting, Representative Dabney, the connection with paid leave, because when we think about infant care, the very best thing that we all can do is make sure the parents can be with their littlest ones. Mm-hmm. I think I know that I shared it all across the committee, and so we want to have policies that can support that. Mr. Gradke, can you comment about this proposal with respect to early care and learning for infants and toddlers and kind of how we should be thinking about this?
Yes, I can. A couple of comments on that. And one of the reasons why we are supporting the removal of the cap, because we're also supporting this becoming 0 to 5. And truly, our discussions have been around programming 0 to 3. And at the $7,500, we cannot provide the kinds of services for infants and toddlers. Early Head Start is a year-round program. It's full day, full year kind of programming. The requirements are much higher for service provision than they are for Head Start. And even though a lot of our Head Start programs are moving into 6+ hours a day, early Head Start is where we know we're making the biggest difference. And so we're supporting, we're asking straight out to have that expand to 0 to 5, knowing that the bulk of that's gonna go to 0 to 3, and knowing that removing the cap will allow us to serve that population better. Right now, that's a huge hindrance for us at $7,500. And truly, I think part of this too, some of the discussion is how we support communities and Head Start, early Head Start programs. We know that we need to provide early Head Start centers and build those things out. We talk about Greater Minnesota, and yes, there's a lot of providers in Greater Minnesota, but we also know there's a tremendous shortage of infant and toddler care. We know that based on our local community needs assessments that programs are required to do. We're trying to meet the needs of those, meet the needs in those communities for the poorest, most at-risk children. Children that oftentimes don't qualify for CCAP and other kinds of assistance, and that do move around quite a bit. And so there is some portability. I know that there are private providers that get pathway to funding. There's a handful of those in the state, and that money, while the money doesn't move, if the children move to another pathway to provider, whatever's left for that goes with that child. It's there for to be spent at that pathway to provider. So there's portability, in that regard. It's just that they have to go to a pathway to provider. There's not a whole lot of those doing infant toddler services. But that's basically because we have a cap on the spending. So, my last comment is I would make is I was there at that table back in the day when Pathway 2 was being negotiated. I was the chair of the association. Gail was negotiating that. And I don't remember that being temporary. And I'd have to check on that. But I don't believe that was the case when we were having those negotiations.
And Mr. Gratke, thank you. And a follow-up question for me that's related to this is there's been the concern expressed in the testimony that Pathway 2 does not work well for small child care centers, for family child care providers. And I guess that's a dual concern. Those tend to be the settings where there tend to be more infants and toddlers Wondering about that concern. Is that kind of how do you respond to that, or what are your thoughts on that point?
Well, I think that goes to licensing because infants and toddlers, if you're a family provider, you can only have so many. And so if you take a number of infants and toddlers on, you reduce your overall capacity. And it's a funding issue too for family providers. The more infants you have, the less children you have, the less revenue you bring in. It's much better to have a bunch of preschoolers. And that's the way the math plays out. That's unfortunate, but that's the way the funding of that plays out. What I can tell you is, again, in Head Start and Early Head Start, we do have child care partnerships, and I have a number of programs that are partnering with child care. And in a number of those settings, the Head Start with 4-star rating comes to those programs, whether they're family providers or center-based providers. They get the Head Start rating in those settings so that they can charge those rates and they can collect the Pathway to money. And we do have providers that we partner with that do bring some of that revenue in. They also get the higher Pathway 1 rate and higher CCAP rates because they're partnering with Head Start. So there's a lot of benefits around all of those kinds of things. And you have to think about it as layering, scaling up the money to provide the highest level of service to the most at-risk kids.
Well, I think even as you described those last couple of sentences, maybe think about Representative Pryor's point about just what a fragmented and complicated system we have, that even is necessary for, and I would think that's an advantage to then larger organizations, because if you're a small organization, it's just so complicated to try to even figure out how to layer these different funding streams. What we really want is for kids to get off to a great start. Well, thank you for that information. Looking to see if there are other questions or comments from members. This has been a really good discussion and will be an ongoing one, I know. I am not seeing anything from anybody else. And so, Chair Dabney, we'll turn to you for final thoughts on the proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I first want to thank Mr. Gratke and Ms. Dunkel for being here today and testifying, as well as the other testifiers for engaging in this discussion. Again, I think Representative Pryor gets the 4-star rating for today because it was her comments that really summed up the challenge. We're all kind of fighting over too small a pot, and that creates stresses and strains and divisions that don't have to be here if we instead centered the needs of children and families. I do want to respond to one dimension. The point was that children experiencing homelessness have been kind of used in this debate. And it's a population that I've long prioritized for attention. I remember a researcher from the Institute of Child Studies, if I get that right, at the University of Minnesota, who several years ago in front of one of the education committees said, if you want to end the achievement gap in Minnesota, end childhood homelessness, because it has such a deleterious impact on children of any age to experience that. And that impact reverberates for years beyond that experience. A public child care provider providing services through a Pathway to Child, or Pathway to Early Learning Scholarship, working with a student child experiencing homelessness, has an ongoing responsibility under the Federal McKinney-Vento Act to continue to provide those services once the family finds stable housing and provide transportation so that that child can experience a continuity of care. The Pathway 1 provider serving that child has no such responsibility. So if the family moves out of a shelter, moves out of a couch hopping situation and finds stable housing, but distant from that Pathway 1 child care provider, that relationship is disrupted because they no longer have physical access. Children and families benefit from stable, quality programming. And I argue that the arbitrary cap the state has put on Pathway to Scholarship retards the growth of an access for families to choose stable, high quality, respected, and reliable early childhood programming in their communities. With that, Mr. Chair, thank you for the time today. It's been a robust conversation and one I'm sure that we will continue, as you've said.
Thank you so much, Chair Dabney, for bringing this forward and instigating this discussion. It's really important, and as you say, I know that it will continue, and in fact, everything is going to accelerate here as we get our budget target and then put together our committee budget. So we'll have, I know, some rich conversations. So with that, the chair lays over House File 2203. As amended, actually, I don't think that we had an amendment on that one, so lays it over for possible inclusion in our Early Childhood Committee budget bill. And then we just have one final, I think it's going to be a pretty short conversation on one final bill. So turning things over back to you, Vice Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we have House File 2231, Early Childhood Family Education removes obsolete language, and Chair Pinto, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move that House File 2231 be recommended for placement on the General Register, and this is, Madam Chair and members, simply a small cleanup that we'd like to send on through to the General Register to clean up our statutes just a bit.
All right, House File 2231 is now before the committee. And Chair Pinto, any more presentation to your bill?
Nothing more, Madam Chair and members.
All right. And are there any member questions? All right. And any other final words, Chair Pinto?
No, thank you, Madam Chair and members.
All right. Chair Pinto removes his motion that House File 2231 be recommended for placement on the General Register. And the clerk will take the roll on the motion. Ms. Chambers.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Aye.
Representative Pryor, Vice Chair.
Aye.
Representative Franson.
Aye.
Representative Bennett.
Aye.
Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Representative Daniels.
Aye.
Representative Dabney?
Aye.
Representative Damon?
Aye.
Representative Juergens?
Juergens, aye.
Representative Cotiza Watun?
Aye.
Representative Morrison?
Morrison, aye.
Representative Wazlowick?
Aye.
Representative Wolgamott? Representative Wolgamott, we have 12 ayes, 0 nays, and 1 abstain.
All right, there being 12 ayes, 0 nays, and 1 abstain, House File 2231 is recommended for placement on the General Register. And with that, I will hand the gavel back to Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. So members, we have an unusual week next week. We're kind of moving into the odd scheduling time here. So we will not be meeting on Tuesday. I would say it's pretty likely that we will have a meeting on Wednesday evening at 6 p.m. And that will likely be relatively short. I'm hopeful, among other things, that by then we'll be able to have just an update from the administration regarding the supplemental budget proposal. I think it's likely that we will not have a meeting then on Thursday of next week. So we will not be meeting at either of our, I know that we won't be meeting on Tuesday, unlikely to be meeting on Thursday. And so just then that would be just the one meeting on Wednesday at 6 p.m. Regarding our scheduling. I see Representative Daniels has a question. So Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. I was looking at my schedule. Typically, Wednesday nights is our sacred night to have caucus meetings. So did you talk to leadership on that already?
Representative Daniels, thanks for asking. I did. Yeah, I think there'll be actually multiple committees meeting next Wednesday evening. They're kind of, things are going to be moving around a bit for a number of committees. So yes, this was actually a time that we were directed to use. And so I assume that will be true. And we probably will have several of our members in this committee moving back and forth between other committees. But yeah, did verify that. Thanks for asking.
Thank you.
So that's the plan. And of course, members, please feel free to reach out with any questions that you may have. Let's see, I don't see any other questions. And so really appreciate your attentiveness and the discussion today. Have a great weekend. And with that, the committee is adjourned. Thanks so much.